The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday night. Hope you're having a nice evening. And it is the weekend, and we are moving into the holiday season. Next week is Thanksgiving, and then insane Black Friday, which is going to be probably more crazy than ever, given the economy. Wait and see. It's always a field day for the lower realms of humanity, or whatever we call it. We have on the line our friend and colleague, Harry Cooper, who is on once a month. Harry is in Jacksonville, Florida tonight. He, of course, the founder and proprietor of sharkhunters.net or .com. .com. Somebody wrote the other day and asked me if it was .net also. But anyway, it's sharkhunters.com, and I want to make that clear. And Harry is on once a month, and we usually take photo trips. We may go somewhere tonight, but they may not be by photo. What we're going to do, though, is look at some remarkable images done by our splash artist, David Dees, who has worked on some books with Harry Cooper that are going to stun you. Look under Harry's name and guests and pull up those covers. What about these books, Harry, and why the new covers? What they are is extraordinary pieces of history to begin with. But why the new covers? And let me tell you, I have never seen ever better World War II vintage depictions in book covers. They're peerless. They're with David Dees. They're incredible.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Your buddy Dees is one heck of an artist, boy. This guy is incredible.
When did the books first come out?
Oh boy. Well, let's see.
Let me rephrase that. The most important thing about the books is that they are full of vignettes and stories and anecdotes by people who lived those days.
That's correct.
That's what makes the books timeless. It doesn't really matter when they came out. What matters is you folks who are interested in World War II history can pick any one of these books up, open it up almost to any page, start reading, and be jerked back in time and just put in the jaws of the most horrific human conflict the planet has ever seen. It is staggering. And somehow David has captured all of that, the timelessness of war, but the strife, the human condition, and in a way, the almost unworldly beauty of some of the scenes of it. I mean, it's dark, it's deadly, but it is stunning. And we have David with us. He'll be on in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to ask him about these covers and what kind of motivation came into play. But they are just stunning. The books,
they're beautiful. They sure are.
The books, Harry, are by friends of yours, basically, people you've
pretty
known
much
in many, many cases. And they are as close as you're going to get, folks, to really understanding what happened in World War II. It's that simple.
That's true. Each one of the books, U-Boat Volume 1, Volume 2, 3, 4, 5, and also When Eagle Soared, Volume 1 and 2, there's not a plot line going through the whole book like a normal novel or something. Each chapter is a separate standalone memory of one of the World War II veterans. U-boat volumes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, of course, are by submarine guys and in some cases American anti-submarine guys. And the Eagles book, volume 1 and 2, are by the flyboys, Luftwaffe guys, as well as American, a couple of Brits, and even one called the Walrus, or what the hell is that? That's about a guy who was the forward gunner on a Supermarine Walrus, which was a flying boat that...
Never heard of it.
Yeah, nobody has, because apparently it was not anything worth beans, but they used it as a scout plane.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who wrote it, just funnier than hell all the way through it, you know, he's talking about how slow it was, and he said one time they were flying along at full speed and a seagull passed them up.
That's too funny.
One time over London, they were flying in a fog and they didn't know what their altitude was. Their altimeter was out, so they dropped a lead line like on the old Mississippi River steamboats, and it happened to hit Nelson's statue in Trafalgar Square.
You're kidding.
Knocked out his other eye and scared the hell out of the pigeons. That whole story about the walrus, you can't just keep a straight face. It's funny. There's others about how Adolf Galland lost his brother, who was also a combat fighter pilot. He got shot down. And some of the other guys, Bobby Hartman, who was also a member of Shark Hunters, the most successful fighter pilot ever in history.
Eric Hartman?
Yeah, Eric
was
Hartman.
A member of Shark Hunters. I want people to know that. And if you understand anything about World War II and fighter pilots, our aces had to score six kills to be five kills to be qualified as an ace. That's in the U.S. Army Air Force, where they were flying P-38s or P-47 Thunderbolts, whatever. It didn't matter.
P-40s, P-51s.
Yeah. They had to shoot down five, and they were an ace. Now, let me just give you an idea. In the German Luftwaffe, over 100 fighter pilots shot down 100 each minimum.
Oh, yeah.
100 each minimum. Now, these were supermen. I'm not saying that they were endemically better than anyone else, but they had to fight literally around the clock. There was no relief for them. They never flew. Some of them fell asleep sitting in the cockpit. They were that exhausted.
Right.
Now, Eric Hartman, just to give you an idea, didn't shoot down five, didn't shoot down 10, not 30, not 50, not 75, not 100, not 150. How many did he shoot down, Harry?
352. The most successful fighter pilot ever in history, and because air combat has changed drastically, there will never be anybody come even close to that.
No.
And they had three guys... I think it was three guys who shot down more than 300. Two. The other one was Barkhorn. He shot down 302. But Hartman was a member of Shark Hunters. I don't know what happened to Barkman. And the third most successful was Gunter Rall. He shot down 275 confirmed. 275.
They were very meticulous and strict about... these kills, too. They could see a plane going down, but unless it was verified by somebody else, I guess they didn't get credit for it.
That is correct. And
Hartman's total could have been 400. We don't know.
Well, yeah. Like I say, confirmed was 352. And
these are, folks, these are machine guns, right? With your finger on the button. These are not air-to-air missiles.
Oh, they had no missiles at that time.
No, of course not.
Machine guns or automatic cannons, 20 millimeter or 37 millimeter.
Yeah.
But no sidewinders.
He had to be absolutely brilliant.
He never got involved in dogfights. He always got the upper hand. He got up into the sun.
Yeah,
he'd pick out his target and he'd dive on it and he waited till he was within less than 100 yards of his intended, and he'd
feet. He'd shoot. Yeah. Sometimes the planes would just absolutely disintegrate on the spot, and pieces would hit his plane, and incredible.
And some of them, I know Gunter Rall got shot down several times. Rudel, the greatest pilot of all time, he was not a fighter ace. He was the Stuka pilot. he got shot down, oh, I think like five times, and at least once, if not twice, I think, behind Russian lines. At one time, I know, he faked an injury,
mm-hmm.
and they had him in a Russian truck, and they were bringing him back to their camp, and he had a chance to jump off and run into the woods and
yeah.
made it back. He was also an ace toward the end during the defense of the Reich when all the bombers and dive bombers were parked and everybody got a fighter plane. I think he got a Focke Wulf FW-190. He
yeah.
still shot down seven planes in the last couple months of the war.
Yeah. Well,
he sank one battleship,
mm-hmm.
I think a cruiser, a bunch of other ships.
And how many tanks?
More than 500 Soviet tanks. And
hard to believe.
He helped refurbish the Argentine Air Force. He and Günter Rall, I'm sorry, with Gallant, him and Gallant, and what the heck was it?
Kurt Tank went down there as well.
Yes, that's correct. He went down with about 50 other aeronautical engineers, and they designed fighter planes for the South American Air Forces, mostly the Argentine. I'm trying to remember the name of that bomber pilot that went down there. He was commander of Company Water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it'll come to you.
Yeah. Well, right now, as you know, I'm fighting a cold. We in Florida, we get colds once a year. Last Tuesday was normal Florida day, 80 degrees. And then the cold front came through, and it went down to 23 degrees at night. And
wow.
Yeah, that always, that's the first cold snap of the year. I always wind up with a cold, so I probably sound like Froggy the Gremlin right now for you old people that remember
no,
Froggy.
No, you sound like Grammy the Froglin. it's no problem. Now, today you were at something very interesting. This is a huge business around the world, believe it or not, and that is the business of World War II memorabilia, shall we call it, military. Icons, military relics, military...
Militaria, right.
Yeah, it's formally called Militaria. But what is the show like this year?
Well, the show is tomorrow and Sunday at the Prine Osborne Convention Center in Jacksonville.
Uh-huh.
This one's a fair-sized show. It's 500 tables. And
did you get a preview?
Show.
Did you get a preview yet?
Well, yeah, we were there to set up, and the place is pretty huge.
Yeah.
It's a gun show and a militaria show combined.
Huh.
So, we were at this show several years ago. We had tables there, but for the last few years we have not, for whatever reason. But we're there again now, and tomorrow and Sunday, it's open to the public, $8 a person to, come in, and there's tons of, things. We've got two tables full of artifacts and also our books.
Well, I hope you sell
the covers.
Yeah, they really should draw a tremendous amount of addition. I hope you sell a lot of them. The issue of militaria is one that we've touched on this before, but there are people who literally, almost without pause, never stopped making certain things from the Third Reich because there's a demand for them. And there's an enormous number of hoaxed items out there, unfortunately.
Oh, there sure are.
I don't even know how to counsel people on finding something real for them. That's not easy to do in some cases. But there are a lot of good things out there. Because a lot
True.
Of the World War II vets who brought things back are passing or did pass, and their surviving spouses, children, are not really knowing what to do with them, so they kind of let him go. That happens.
Yeah, that happens a lot. And a fellow who was a member of Shark Hunters, he was also my son's godfather. He used to go into North Florida and hang up wanted posters, wanted information on any downed airplanes, because we had more than 400 training bases in Florida during the war. And they were crashing planes all the time in the swamp. And
400 training bases?
Yeah.
We just overwhelmed Germany. Overwhelmed them.
Well, yeah.
Good Lord.
Nobody could keep up with the manufacturing capabilities of the U.S. in those days. And so he'd offer $500 to anybody who could show him where there was a downed airplane.
Uh-huh.
And he'd bring it back and renovate the thing and sell it for tons of money. And, excuse me.
Sorry.
But unfortunately, like you say, the dyes, the molds, for instance, for mm-hmm. the various metals were never destroyed. And so if people get a hold of those metals, those dyes,
yeah.
they use the same amalgams, and they cast genuine World War II medals that were made last week, and nobody can spot them.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there was one member of Shark Hunters we had to throw out with dishonorable discharge. He was member number 3,
oh.
and we're up to 7,800 now.
Mm-hmm.
He was a crewman on U-505. And he, you know, he was very believable. People would come to his booth at these military shows. Very engaging. He really was on all those combat tours. And they came to visit me in the early 90s. And like the part of Florida where I lived so much, they bought a house only about a half a mile from me. And I visited all the time. Excuse me. And one day
he was a legitimate U-boat survivor.
Oh, yeah. He was mm-hmm. on U-505, every mm-hmm. one of their combat patrols.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the guys that you see in the film when they're capturing the boat. So he really was on all those things. And so he and his girlfriend came to this country as tourists and then just never went home. He got a job as a machinist. His girlfriend, who later became his wife, they got a restaurant for her. They bought a house. It's not what you do on a vacation. And so INS raided the factory where he worked, and they found all these illegal Mexicans plus one illegal German. They didn't know what to do with him. So at that time, you know, he was a decent guy. So I got letters from a lot of our important members, and I sent them all to Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, who was a member of Shark Hunters, and said, mm-hmm. hey, let's help this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they did. They gave him an exception till he got his citizenship, or at least a green card. And then I went over to visit him at his house after they moved by us. And I walked in the front door, and there's a big carton full of U-boat combat badges, U-boat-Kriegsabzeichen. And they were reproductions. So, you know, I asked him, I said, what the hell's all this? He says, well, you know, I've won the Oberskriegsabzeichen. I said, yeah, you won one of them. You got about 300 here, and these are all reproductions. Well, you know, when you get the award, you can buy others to put on your uniform. I said, yeah, but you don't have a uniform, and these are all fakes. So he was taking them to gun shows. They were costing him about $30-$35 a piece at the time.
Yeah.
And he was selling them at military shows, gun shows. Ja, das war mein Kriegsabzeichen. And he was getting $300, $400 for them. Bad enough he was cheating people out of money. He was cheating people out of honest history. So as soon as we found out.
Yeah, that's disgraceful.
Yes, it is. And I put it before my advisory board. And at that time, Otto Kretschmer was one of the guys on the board.
U-boat skipper.
And I still remember the letter. He's in the letter. He said, take no half measures, Harry. Put him out immediately. So we put him out dishonorably.
Wow. See, there's another example of World War II German military code of honor behavior. No
yeah.
question. They just didn't play games.
No, for the most part, he's the only dishonorable one
that you've probably ever run into.
That's
yeah.
right. All the rest of them, they're just fanatically honorable. And this guy was doing fine, too. Well, I met him first in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And he met this little French dolly who was about half his age. And he left his wife of many decades, walked out on her and his children with her,
mm-hmm.
take up with this other person, and she's the one who everything she saw had dollar signs. So it got him to where he he just abandoned his morality.
Yeah.
But for the most part, though, you find guys who, you know, there was a guy named Bruno who was a survivor of the Bismarck. He was an honorable man. At another military show I was at a few years ago, they had, what the hell was his name, Walter Schunk. He had shot down 200 airplanes, and they also had the U.S. Army Air Force pilot that shot him down. Signing mm-hmm. autographs. Now, this was an honorable man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an interesting battle, too, because Walter Schunk had shot down 200 in combat, and this rookie lieutenant comes up, and somehow it got favorable, and he shot down Schunk, and within minutes, he got shot down himself.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday's enemies are today's friends. They were sitting together signing autographs at a different military show.
We also want to point out that pilots who bailed out were not under orders, German orders, to be shot in their parachutes. That was absolutely not true.
That's an interesting situation. You know, they talk about how, for instance, the story was, of course, that the German U-boaters always machine gun people in the water, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
But of course, the U.S. Navy guys, they did quite a bit. And when Mush Morton, commanding USS Wahoo, sank a Japanese troop transport in broad daylight, he looked through the scope, and in his logbook, he put that he saw about 10,000 Imperial Marines bobbing around in their life jackets. And he surfaced the submarine and spent the next hour killing everybody in the water. So we got to looking into this, and there is a treaty. I forget the name of the treaty. It was done either during World War I or just after. It may sound barbaric, and it probably is barbaric, but if...
Harry, hold that thought. We have to take a break.
Hold that thought.
Yeah, that's a good place to pause. We'll come back, finish that story, and then bring David Dees on here. We're going to go through the books, and do bring them up. They're right there in guests under Harry Cooper's name.
Yeah, so, they look fantastic.
Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, and we are back. All right, Mr. Cooper, let's finish that story, a treaty of some kind.
Yeah, it, like I say, it might not be moral, and it might not be very nice, but the way this treaty reads, if you're in a ship and you sink another ship, if he's within his own territorial waters or his own controlled waters, like when Wahoo sank this transport, they were sunk in Japanese-controlled waters. They would have been picked up by Japanese ships and used against American Marines. So at that point, it's fair, according to this treaty, to kill the people in the water. Likewise, fighter pilots, for instance, will say over Germany, if a German shoots down an American plane and a guy gets out in his parachute, hits the silk, the treaty says leave him go because the people on the ground are going to catch him and put him in the POW camp. But if the American shoots down a German, over Germany, it's okay to gun him in his chute because once he gets to the ground, he's going to get another airplane and come back at you. And a perfect example was Günter Rall, as I was going to say, the third most successful fighter pilot. I visited with him in his home in Bad Reichenhall in southern Bavaria. Funny guy, spoke perfect English. And he was showing me his hand that was missing a thumb. And he said, Hub Zemke and his people shot off my thumb and they saved my life. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I was diving on two of his Thunderbolts and shooting them down. And two more Thunderbolts were diving on me and my airplane was on fire. And a bullet came and it shot off my thumb and they saved my life. I says, General, what the hell are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. And with a little twinkle in his eye, he said, I bailed out of my airplane. And when I got to the ground, if I still had my thumb, the Luftwaffe would say, take another airplane, go up and die. So according to this treaty, if you incapacitate the enemy combatant. If he's in his own backyard, you can go ahead and kill him because he's just going to get another plane, ship, whatever, and come after you. But if you shoot him down over your territory, his enemy territory, don't worry about him because the people on the ground are going to catch him and put him in a POW camp. Likewise, if an enemy soldier throws down his rifle and walks towards you with his hands in the air, take him prisoner. But if he turns around and runs the other way, it's okay to shoot him in the back because he's just going for another weapon. That's the way the treaty reads. It doesn't seem very nice, but then again, war ain't very nice.
Now, is that an actual exact approximate number, 10,000 Japanese troops on one ship?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They had big ships. When our troops, our American troops were transiting with the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth, I think they had way more than that. I think so. But anyhow, Mush Morton put down that one of the 20 millimeters, the gun tube jammed, and so they had to replace the gun tube and, quote, continue strafing survivors, unquote. They were even using a 45 sidearm. They were using the 5-inch deck gun. And, you know, you can see his point.
Well, the water must have been red.
It must have been, yeah, the sharks must have had a great time. Yeah. And I talked to another American submarine officer, and he said, if we sank a ship, Japanese ship, out in the middle of Mother Ocean, it was easy to be gallant and let them go, because you know they were going to die anyhow. But if you sank the ship in Japanese water, he said, we made sure nobody in the other uniform was still alive. Another one of our members who was a PT boat crewman, he said that after a while the PT boats were turned into gun platforms, and he said when an American sub would sink a Japanese ship in Japanese water, the PT boats were called on to go out and kill them all.
Okay, let's go and take a look at the books, because they do capture some of what we're talking about. In fact, a lot of it.
Boy, I'll
and,
tell you.
Yeah. David, are you there?
I am here.
How are you?
I'm good. Hello, Harry.
Hey, David. Nice to talk to you finally. We've been doing all our conversation through the email.
That's true. Yeah, we just did, we've done 7 covers now, and you were asking at the beginning of the show, you were talking about my inspiration for them. I can give you that if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
Okay,
David.
Actually, you've done 9 covers for us when you count Hitler in Argentina and also Hitler in the Secret Alliance.
Yeah.
That's right. He sent me the PDFs, and I began reading these. And the interesting thing about Harry's books are that they're not really political. They mostly are written from, like diaries almost, from the person who experienced them. And any subject that I start to illustrate, I always want to know what I'm looking at. I have to understand it, you know, from many different angles so I can get an idea of how to bring a visual that the person, the viewer, will understand the feeling of it. And so when I started reading about the U-boat, the first ones I did was the U-boat, I didn't understand this is not a normal submarine as we think about a submarine in America. These submarines that the Germans built, which literally ruled the Atlantic, they really took over that whole section of the planet because they were so crafty. These boats, they called them U-boats, but they were submarines, but the top of them was flat and had a surface where they could come out the top, and the whole crew could come out if it was a nice day and out on the ocean, and they could go swimming, and they could walk around and enjoy themselves up in the sunshine. So they weren't stuck inside the submarines the whole time. And sometimes they got surprised by enemy aircraft when they would be up there enjoying themselves, and then suddenly, you know, they would be. That's how they could sink them. They could surprise them that way.
So
I started looking at documentary films that the Germans had made about the inside of the submarines, these U-boats, and the inside. It was about the size of a fuselage of maybe a Delta airliner. But you also had the engine in there with you, and all the machinery was inside there. So there was a very narrow area where they had to operate, and they would put something like 40 men in there. And the men were so young. You know, you think about men, but these were children. They were 17 years old, 18 years old maybe, and the skipper was 25. So it was It was a harrowing thing they were doing, and I don't know what the percentage of these men that went out made it.
Well,
back.
It's a horrific percentage. David, did you see the movie Das Boot? Boat. Some people say boot, but it is boat. We always want to make that clear. Das
That's
Boat.
That's correct. Das Boot. That's German.
Yeah, did you see that movie?
I started watching that for reference because I went through a lot of documentaries.
It's staggeringly real. It's
fantastic movie.
I lived in
one man out of David.
Ago.
David, one man out of seven came home.
That's it.
One man out of seven. Well,
right.
Once they came ashore, once they came to dock, they turned around and went right back out. That's probably why there were so many losses. These guys were, what people don't realize, and I apologize to anybody listening that fought in World War II and was told these years that this was the good war. This was anything but a good war. My experience of learning about the real history behind World War II was the Germans were really defending Germany. If you know about World War I, how they redrew the borders of Germany and included parts of Poland and into France, and the Bolsheviks in Poland were massacring Germans. That's why Hitler had to go into Poland.
Exactly.
He was not going to take over the world like the Zionist media wants you to believe. This was not the case. And why would, how else could you motivate all these young German men to fight so gallantly? They were really defending Germany, and when they were beating France and England so easily, the Zionists had to bring in America to really
turn the tables,
roll over
right.
them. I mean, please.
Yeah, hold on, David.
Started.
No, I know. Hold on a minute. We have to pause for a little break. We'll come right back with David Dees and Harry Cooper and yours truly. Okay, and we're back. Harry Cooper and I are here with you, and Harry's with us once a month for 2 hours on Friday, the third Friday of each month. He is in Florida right now. I am on the other side of the country, as is David Dees. David's been talking about his feelings as someone who got involved with this project of creating brand new art covers for some of the most important books ever assembled about World War II, and that's no exaggeration. And he has been talking about his feelings about the war and when he researches it and the things that come to him emotionally, intellectually, mentally, and he has stated it exactly correctly. Harry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the front covers of these books, several of them depict guys who were members of Shark Hunters, and I'll give you a couple little insights into each of them.
Let's start at the top, and
okay.
We're going to go right through. You can't see, but I have them
also
on the page. Go ahead, David.
Can you direct them to the link so we can
mentioning it. It's right in the guests section under Harry Cooper's name.
Right.
You'll see it. Just go there. Take a
and
look.
And your listeners can also go to sharkhunters.com, and they can buy these books.
You want a stocking stuffer for someone who cares about history? You could not do better. What a treat. Get a couple of three of these books and just stick them in the stocking.
The nice thing about it, Jeff, I met most of these guys. I knew most of these guys.
Yeah.
They were all friends.
Yes.
And, for instance, on volume two, the front cover, that's Eric Topp at the Periscope, the third most successful submarine commander.
Yeah. Well,
World War II.
Yeah, let's get to that in a minute. Let me hold on, please. Click on Books by Harry Cooper under Harry's name. It says Harry Cooper, World War II Books by Harry Cooper, and click on Books by Harry Cooper, and you'll bring up the page. And well, let's start, first of all, with Hitler in Argentina, which was David's first book for you.
Right.
And that has taken a story that you broke literally to the world first decades and has been ridiculously pilfered and looted by con artist after con artist. But it was Harry Cooper who put this data together from people who were there. There was one man who contributed largely to the book who was in the bunker. All right? This is no
joke.
This is no joke.
That was, Right. Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco. He was a Spaniard who worked for the Third Reich. And in the final couple of months of the war, his post was in the Führer bunker. And one of his duties was to make a report to Hitler himself every day about some phase of the war. And then he personally saw Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, who was by then Eva Hitler, saw them forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann and removed from the Führer bunker and taken to South America.
They're carried out on stretchers, correct?
Well, carried out. No, people propping them up.
Uh-huh.
When Eva left, she was walking, barely dragging, her feet shuffling, and she was propped up by two other girls. And one of our researchers, Michael Ivanheim, who wrote the second book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance, he thinks he's pretty well identified these two women as a pair of dykes, as uh-huh. he puts it, and uh-huh. That they popped up in South America also. But unlike some of these people who have lifted my work and also lifted the work of Ebel Basti down in Argentina, I go to Germany every year, sometimes as many as five times a year, to visit with these veterans and do my research. I just got back a couple of months ago from Bavaria and Austria. I've been in Argentina four times, twice to Hitler's estate, which you see on the front cover of the book. That's a picture I took of Hitler's estate. Interesting thing, another one of my people, we call him or her Pizarro found that from 23rd of April onward, Adolf Hitler did not sign any orders. All the orders from 23rd April onward were signed by Martin Bormann.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're pretty confident that Hitler was taken out on the 23rd when it was still possible to get in and out through one corridor in Berlin. The Red Army hadn't closed the ring yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if Hitler was there, why wasn't he signing the orders? And, of course, Stalin, in July of 1945, 3 months after the alleged suicide, he was screaming publicly that the United States and England were not doing enough to find Hitler. Well, if Hitler's dead and you got his body, why do you want people to look for him?
Of course.
Stalin knew he was gone, and in that book, Hitler in Argentina, we published comments from many of the world leaders at the time. Truman asked Stalin.
Fascinating.
Stalin told him he's not dead.
That's right.
And various other leaders.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover found out in a back doorway that Hitler was not dead and he should stop looking for him. It's kind
right.
of a funny
and,
story in itself.
One of our guys, one of our agents, a person we call Taucher, which means diver, this person spent several weeks in the National Archives about 6 or 7 years ago finding dust-covered boxes that the archivists didn't even know they had, finding all these secret FBI files in there,
mm-hmm.
which he got declassified, and we've got copies of it, dozens and dozens of FBI and CIA documents stating they knew Hitler got away. They knew Hitler was in Argentina. This was in 1945, 1946. So all our spook agencies knew it. Our government knew it. The Soviet government knew it.
And the reason, ladies and gentlemen, technology. The big trade was Hitler.
Right.
And the escape route for many, many, many members of the German government,
thousands
industrial class, tens of thousands perhaps, made it to Argentina in exchange for people like Wernher von Braun and others who were ultimately to take us to the moon. It was all about technology. If you look at the front cover of the book that David did, it's brilliant. We suspect that aircraft is the one that flew Hitler and Eva to Argentina. We also look at the back of the cover, and if you look at many pictures of Hitler, you can tell that is him. That is a photograph of him shortly before he died. Look at the nose, look at the nostrils. Hitler's left nostril, our right, was lower than his right nostril, which we see on the left. Take a look at it when he was a very young man in the 30s and then a very old man in the early 1960s. And you'll see a nose that has gotten puffier as noses do, but it's the same nostril configuration, the same mouth, it's the same face. They may have put a dimple in his chin through cosmetic surgery down there. That's unclear, but it's obviously Hitler. Look at the ears. The ears grow as you get older, too, but it's the same ear. It's obviously him. There is really no question about this, none. David, when you got this first inkling that I told you there was a possibility of doing this book, what went through your head? What did you think about this?
The cover of Hitler in Argentina?
Yeah. Yeah.
What went through my head? Well, I was very honored to be doing this bit of history. Harry has done what few people have ever done, is he's assembled history, real history. He's gone and interviewed these people, the eyewitnesses. He's traveled all over South America. He went to the place where the house where Hitler was living and interviewed, you know, the waitress that waited on him and Eva Braun at the restaurant there in that town. And, you know,
1949.
After he died,
supposedly.
In addition to that, he was taken out to that house built by the Mercedes family on a boat skippered by a man who grew up on the estate when Hitler and Eva were living there as a boy for years. And we're hopeful that Harry will be able to connect with him. He's still alive, and he has a story to tell.
We finally found out his name. We got his name now.
All right. Well, we'll get him.
I will say that the honor was in, you know, I like most people that are listening, I grew up with World War II movies and was indoctrinated on the fact that Hitler was the most evil person on the planet. But now, with the research I've done and a lot of people, the conclusion a lot of people came to was we realized that the media has painted him to be that way, and he was actually one of the greatest leaders this planet has ever known. And my respect for this man, it's so astronomical. I can gladly tell you that. And anyone that would research the man and the path that Germany had to go through to just exist, and then to turn it around and become one of the most powerful on the planet.
They were punished after World War One, David, more severely than any country I have ever come across in my studies of history.
Yeah, and that's why I put him on the cover of the first U-boat. I understood that there was a story where Hitler came onto one of the U-boats, and they painted this whole image of him and the people around him. And I just had to include him on the cover of the first one. There's five on the U-boat series, and each one is packed. I think it's got, I don't know, maybe about 12 to 15 or 20 chapters, and each one is written by a different person from their viewpoint of the war. It's amazing. I often don't read these books that I illustrate, but I got very sucked into this one. This was wonderful.
Yeah, once you get into it, you can't put them down. And as David said, there's five books in the U-boat series so far. Keep your pen and ink handy, David. There's a bunch more coming down the road within the next 6 months.
All right. Well, great.
Because all these stories have been in our monthly magazine over the years, and thank God I've got them all onto the computer, so we just, you know, copy and paste. So we're going to start putting out probably four more in 2015, if not more than that, plus a few more Flyboy books, When Eagles Soared.
Great. All right. Wonderful. Very good. Stand by. We have to take a break. We'll come right back in about 6-7 minutes. Hold on. Okay, and we're back. Harry Cooper and yours truly, along with David Deeds. David is our just peerless, magnificently talented and gifted and humble artist at Rents.com, and his art is seen all around the world. He has truly attained a position in political art that has never been, he's recreated political art is what he's done. And now he is producing the most wonderful evocative, emotive covers in World War II books I have ever seen. We're looking at the books by Harry Cooper. Look at Harry Cooper's name in Guests at Rents. Look at Books by Harry Cooper. Click on that line under his name. It's the second line. And you'll pull the page up, and we're looking at those books right now. David, when you look at the picture, originally I think I sent you three, but when you look at the picture of Adolf Hitler on the back cover, and had all three been in there, there wasn't room for them, but I think they really show the unquestionable doubt that that's the same face. That's the man.
That is the man. You were talking about his nostril. Yeah, that's a very telling detail that it looks exactly like when people age, the nose, the ears, and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. He how old was he when he died, Harry?
He died in 1962 or 63. So do the math. He was born 1889.
That would make him 74, 75.
Thereabouts, yeah.
And
incidentally,
and he doesn't have the mustache there, you can see.
No.
Right, no. When Don Angel met with him in 1952, Don Angel said he had gone bald and he had no more mustache.
Well, that's
incidentally, one of our guys, Pizarro, has learned the name of the double that took his place in the bunker, and that was in the last issue of the magazine. You got that.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Now, was he the one that they put a bullet in his head and put him outside to be found by the Soviets, or was that somebody else?
We're not sure just yet.
Okay. All right. Well,
but also, if you think about from his viewpoint, everybody was told that he was dead. And so he was in Argentina watching the whole world talk about his death and create all these dastardly things that he did, like the so-called Holocaust. And he got to live until, 1963. And he saw so many things. It's so interesting when you think about that they were alive and how heartbroken they must have been to see Germany so destroyed by the people.
And continue to be destroyed from 1945 to 1953, where 5 to 8 million more Germans were butchered by World Zionism to kill off any residual patriotic German identity. That's what their game was. And Germany has been on its knees ever since.
The new generation, though, I'm in contact with a lot of people over there. The new generation, which is about the third generation after the war, they're not believing it. They're not. They're getting tired of the sackcloth and ashes.
That's right.
And we're trying to find a translator now who will put our book into German, because some of our German members have been just pushing the hell out of us.
Can't believe it hasn't happened already. Any of you people in Germany listening. It doesn't cost a whole hell of a lot to have a book translated. Let's put the money together and get this done, okay? Maybe the German government will outlaw it as for sale in Germany, but you can buy it overseas and have it shipped in. So get it. Let's get
right.
It done.
It's going to be released within the next week or two in the French language.
Good.
Michael Ivanheim's daughter is translating it into Spanish, so that ought to be big down in South America and in Spain.
Very good.
Now we need to get it into German, and because there's a lot of people in Germany would love to learn their history.
Indeed, the truth. All right, well, there it is, Hitler in Argentina, David Dee's artwork, Harry Cooper and his incredible associates have put the truth there. Let's scroll down and look at When Eagles Soared, Volume 1. How did you select the font is perfect, David. It's almost evocative of World War I in its breadth, but look at that plane and look at the man behind it. The man behind it was so incensed that Adolf Hitler still in World War I in some ways, in Hitler's own mind, would not allow the Messerschmitt 262, which he had access to by 1942, to be turned into an air superiority fighter. He didn't get it. He wanted it to be a Schnell bomber to fly over and drop bombs or a bomb on London and fly back. No one can touch it. Yeah, and he wasted 2 years. Had he not done that, the war would have been much different. I don't know how it would have ended, You overrun people with so many others, you overrun them. But still, they would have swept the skies clean of some of these bomber formations. Lots of them. Hey, David, what about this book and Adolf Galland?
Well, this cover is depicting an aerial battle. I chose the this. It's a Messerschmitt there, right? I'm not sure exactly which model.
That's an ME-109, yeah.
And well, technically,
that's Galland,
it's a,
right?
A B, yeah, that's Galland. And it's Galland. Technically, it's a BF-109, but everyone says ME.
Bayern Flugzeug.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
I just chose the most dynamic angle that I could. It's dive bombing with full machine guns going, and in the background you can see a British plane exploding. I don't know what model that is. I don't know all the numbers of the technical part of all this. But
that's a Spitfire.
And maybe some of the first chemtrails there because, well, it's actually black smoke, but it's a lot of lines in the sky. A lot of activity. You know, I was looking at some of the dogfights taken from the machine gunner. The machine gunners had a spot sometimes at the front of the plane and in the back, and they would have, they would take movies of these battles, and I was looking at some of these. Holy smokes, you know, we're talking about danger on a level that no one even can comprehend. And these planes, you think, you know, the B-17 was called a flying fortress. Well, I was studying the photograph. The inside of it is not much wider than a big Jeep. You know, it's a very small plane considering, you know, what sort of situation they put themselves in, being surrounded by all these Stukas and the Messerschmitts, you know, shooting them down. You know, I really was able to feel the danger and it scared me really bad. I have to say is that I got really scared researching some of this stuff and the feelings I got from it.
One other thing. The plane on the cover of the book, I want all of you to take a look right under the cockpit window on the side of the fuselage. What do you see?
Yeah, his emblem.
You see Adolf Galland's favorite little cartoon character by the name of Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse smoking a cigar with a six-shooter in his hand.
And I sent two videotapes to Mrs. Galland of 1930s Walt Disney Mickey Mouse cartoons for Adolf, and he got them, and she wrote me a very lovely letter back.
So. Yeah, he's gone now. He died under the knife on the operating table. He was having open-heart surgery some years ago. He was a member of Shark Hunters. And
did you ever meet him?
No, never met him. We wrote back and forth, but most of the U-boat guys I met, but Galland I didn't meet. I did meet Günter Rohl, as I said, and spent a day with him. Hans Eckhard Bob. He flew the jet fighters, Hans Eckhard Bob did. And he signed one of our prints, which you can find on our store. And we also have, you mentioned gun camera footage. We've got DVDs, and many of them have actual gun camera stuff. Some of them from the Japanese Air Force shooting down British planes. So the gun cameras, there'll never be air war again like this, where the men actually saw their opponent through a spinning propeller and had to aim the plane to shoot the other guy down. Now they just, I was in the Air Force, so I was a weapons specialist, and they just fly off and they stay on a radar beam, and then their little scope says fire, you push a button, and you turn around and go home.
Well, exactly, Harry, and they're the forward shooting cannons or machine guns on the BF-109s or any of the planes. When you were in a dogfight in combat, you had to lead your opponent with your gunfire. They call it deflection. And Eric Hartmann was a genius at deflection. He would know how to shoot, how far ahead of the plane. So by the time the bullets arrived, they'd arrive on target.
Right. Well, he must have learned something, right, with 352 confirmed shoot downs.
Yeah, his story is incredible.
He was.
And also, you have to consider how he would dodge, you know, anybody shooting at him to be able to be in that much aero combat to not get shot down. He, how do you? What is
he
the?
He stayed out of dogfights.
technique that you could ever avoid so much fire.
He had a great wingman, too, by the way.
Right, he had a great wingman, and he stayed out of dogfights. He'd dive, he'd pick out his target, dive on him, gun the guy down, and keep right on.
His job was to reduce the enemy's air potential.
Yeah, by attrition.
Yeah.
And just like the U-boats, what they did was they were so dangerous, the U-boats were so dangerous, that they started putting weapons on the freighters that were, the cargo ships started mm-hmm. to have weapons on them. And so now the U-boats, the submarines, you know, had orders to shoot to fire torpedoes on them too. So you had not necessarily a warship that suddenly was being sunk with a lot of people on it. You know?
Well, yeah, they started arming the freighters, which made them fair targets. Prior to that, they abided by the cruiser rules or the prize rules, where they'd stop a ship and check the cargo manifest, and if it was carrying war material, they'd let the crew get off into the lifeboats and then sink the ship. But after a while, they didn't dare come to the surface because, as David said, they armed them, but not with depth charges or anything like that, but with guns, cannons. And so if a submarine would surface, his element of surprise was gone, and they had 3-inch and 5-inch deck guns, and they could easily blow a submarine out of the water. So that's why they started firing from underneath. And the U-boats, they'd get within 300, 400 yards of a ship to make sure they hit it, whereas you know, the American boats would fire from 1,500 yards out or 1,000 yards out. And I hope our Italian friends don't take this as an insult, but the Italian submarines that see a smudge of smoke on the horizon, fire 6 torpedoes, go home and claim they sank 3 battleships and get the gold medal for it. The Germans got so close that they'd be rocked by the explosion of their own torpedoes.
Well, that was...
Kretschmer would get inside
Germans
of a
really
convoy.
Were winning the war. Sorry.
Kretschmer.
The Germans were really winning the war at that point because they were controlling all the boats, right?
Well, pretty much, yeah. And Kretschmer, like I say, he was a good friend of mine right up until the time he died in a horrible accident. He'd get inside the convoy, and nobody could get him. And his motto was one ship, one torpedo. And he was the top submarine commander of World War II.
It all turned when the British cracked the Germans' Enigma secret transmission code.
And right, May of 1944.
I will never understand why the Germans didn't routinely change the code. I don't understand.
43, I'm sorry.
43.
Well, not only that, Jeff. Black May of 43 was when the code was cracked. It's also when Huffduff came on high-frequency direction finder.
Yeah.
Prior to that, you would have to rotate a loop to get the direction a radio uh-huh. signal was coming from, and the U-boat radio operator could send out what they call a Kurtz signal. It took 2 or 3 seconds, and it had a bunch of coded letters which told their position, how much fuel they had, what torpedoes they had, etc. And in 2 or 3 seconds, it was impossible to triangulate using the old RDF. But when Huffduff came on the scene, as soon as that guy hit the key, he was triangulated, and within 15 minutes, bombers were overhead. And in the case of the Type 14, the seagoing gas stations, you want to call them, the U-boat tankers that would fill the other boats in combat, they had no concept of security. We talked to some guys who met one of the U-tankers near the Azores.
Milchkow.
Milchkow, that's correct. 2 Type 9 C U-boats came alongside, one on either side, a distance of 100, 200 feet off, and they were taking on fuel. And he said as soon as they got to the surface, they doubled the men on the anti-aircraft guns, doubled the lookouts on the Type 9s. But the Type 14, nobody was at the guns. The guys were just lounging at the rail, smoking. And once the two front boats, as they call them, the combat boats, once they got their fuel load, they took off in opposite directions. And with less than a half hour after they left the milk cow, they could hear the milk cow on the radio sending messages back to the base explaining long radio messages, so the two Type 9s pulled the plug and went down, and within 15 minutes they heard explosions from back where the Type 14 had been, and it was no more. They were a high priority target by the U.S. because they could keep 5, 6, 7 front boats on station longer by giving them extra fuel.
Got it. Well, all right. Let's look at the second cover on the page. This is dedicated to the Army Air Corps. It shows a B-17, the Memphis Belle.
Right. Bob Morgan was a member of Shark Hunters, too.
Wow. And on
He died a rather weird way. He married a much younger woman, Linda, and she was his manager, et cetera. And they were in, I think it was Charleston or Charlotte, I'm not sure which one. And they were walking, and he tripped and fell off the curb and banged his head, and that was it.
That's strange.
Hell of a way.
Yeah. David?
But his plane was the first one to complete the obligatory 25 missions to be rotated home.
Yeah, now what you've done is just, I mean, I when I see that picture under the title, When Eagle Soared, Volume 2, I look at the man kissing the gal, and you hear the song, I'll Be Seeing You. I mean, that you've captured the nostalgic epoch of American history perfectly with that cover.
Yeah.
There's a lot of romance with this cover. It's the colors I chose and putting the couple, it was very romantic, and it's, they painted on the front of the aircraft there, the Memphis Belle, and they put a pinup girl. I guess, you know, I don't know the exact story there, but I know that, she probably inspired this whole art, right?
Well, all the planes, most of the planes had pinups. Some of them were so, they went over the top with revealing certain parts of the women, and the commanding officers forced them to change them or cover them up.
Put some bathing suits on them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They called that nose art, because it was art on the nose of the plane.
There's a book
out. But
with
the Memphis Belle, Morgan, when he was a young cadet, he had a girlfriend from Memphis, and she was a Southern Belle, and I guess she was the fiancé, but the marriage never happened. They broke up or something, and he married somebody else. And then later on, either his wife either died or they got divorced. I don't remember which. But Linda, I can't remember her last name before she married him. She wanted to be an airplane salesman, so she got her pilot's license when she was in her late 20s. And then she met Morgan, and they got married. And she managed his appearances, et cetera. And then, like I say, he was walking and tripped off the sidewalk and hit his head.
Yeah, wild. By the way, one quick thing, David. When you look, folks, at the B-17, you younger people, the Americans are producing so many. They produced over 10,000 of those.
Yeah.
And they would send them over Germany in formations of up to 1,000 airplanes at a time.
Yeah.
And I've talked to Germans.
Three different levels.
That's right. I've talked to Germans who were there as young kids, and they'd go outside the cities, of course, and sit on the hills, and they'd watch these raids. And they said when the planes came, you could hear them before you could see them, the rumbling. The ground shook, and then the bombs were dropped. It was just a horrific thing. And they did that
to
Germany.
They referred to that as the aluminum overcast.
There you go. They did that to Germany from 1941 on. And somehow the Germans continued to fight. They moved all their aircraft production facilities underground. They ran out of fuel. They ran out of pilots. And yet they were still at it at the end. It's just an extraordinary effort to survive.
They were tough combat soldiers, that's for sure, in whatever branch. They were tough combatants. They just didn't know how to quit.
Yeah. They couldn't kill the Soviet hordes fast enough. Their machine guns would actually melt down. The barrels would become misshapen, apparently. They just couldn't.
What a lot of people don't realize is that the Third Reich never surrendered. Jodl and Keitel surrendered the military, but the government of the Third Reich never surrendered because they had disappeared. the same as the Civil War or the War of Northern Aggression, as you want to call it. The South never surrendered. The government never surrendered. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia against orders, but the government of the Confederate States never surrendered. The government of the Third Reich never surrendered. Hell of a note, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Okay, let's, well, we have just a minute left, but let's move on to the first of the U-boat covers. Again, volume one, Stories from the Men of the U-boat Waffe, and it is extraordinary. Now, that is a color photograph, folks, from the war. That's amazing.
That's a Type 7.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I'm not sure if it was colorized. You know, I worked with a lot of photographs. When you go to research this, there's tons of photographs. Not very many of them are good quality that you want to put on the cover of a book. But I was able to recreate some of the scenes and sort of put it from a viewpoint. For instance, the second cover is from the viewpoint of the water and having a sinking ship, and then the periscope, the skipper's on the periscope underneath the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting way to illustrate underwater and above water at the same time.
Well,
the boat you've got depicted, it's an interesting story. That's U-30, and the skipper there, that's Fritz Julius Lemp, who was the skipper of U-30. And the radio operator on that boat was a member of Shark Hunters. He just passed away last year. He was a good friend of mine, Jörg Hugel. And this submarine has the distinction of being many firsts. It was the first boat into combat. It was the first boat to fire a torpedo. They blew up a rock they thought was a cruiser. It was the first boat to sink a ship. They sank the liner Athenia, which they weren't supposed to sink. And so Hugel himself had to tear the pages out of his logbook that covered that because it was a huge international incident. They were the first boat into a captured French port. They came into Lorient when the city was still in flames. And that was a Type 7A. There were only 10 built, and by 1941, five of them were already sunk.
Wow.
So much for the happy times.
Yeah,
Otto
French
created that term.
Indeed. All right, we'll be right back with more in just a couple minutes. Okay, Harry Cooper in Florida and David Deves on the West Coast, and we're talking about World War II, happened long ago. For those of you saying, well, why aren't you talking about American military people and Navy people and British and French? Well, they get the lion's share of the publicity. We're talking about the underdogs here who didn't get that kind of, shall we say, glorified coverage, which quite frankly is what it was. It was propaganda. It was wartime. And even since then, it hasn't changed much. Volume 3, David?
Volume 3, I had the idea of showing, while I was researching that these aircraft carriers were in the Atlantic, and did a submarine ever sink one of those? And yes, they did. And if you did, you got the Knight's Cross medal for sinking one, that or a battleship, I believe. And there, the cover you see, there's no image like this. I built this out of explosions and finding out what a torpedo looks like skimming under the water. You know, I remember as a kid, I saw a lot of war movies, and you know, I used to see that image of the torpedo that was just under the surface, and
serious,
you know, it was
stuff
stuck in my head.
Yeah.
So I wanted to recreate that, and so I've got it's a pretty simple image, but it's very powerful. I think it shows an aircraft carrier being hit by a torpedo with a very dark sky behind.
We had several Jeep carriers. That's what they call them, Jeep carriers, because they were built on the 11,000-ton cruiser frames, and there was one that did get sunk. Just, I think it was off Gibraltar, I'm not sure. But
how many aircraft could they carry? What, 10, 15?
Two dozen.
Uh-huh.
Two dozen. Yeah, because they had a hangar deck down below. They had the elevators to bring them down below. And then they also had what the heck was that? That was the CVL, I think, the light carrier, 11,000 tons. Then they had the CVEs, like the USS Guadalcanal, which was built on a 5,000-ton cargo ship hull. But the USS, the heck was it, the Bogue, yeah, USS Bogue did get sunk by a German submarine, which in turn got pounced on by the destroyers, and it got sunk. That was usually, if you attacked an American surface fleet with the Jeep carrier, you were going to get whacked, because those were the hunter-killer groups. They were not escorting convoys that had to watch out for their ships. These guys would go out with a light carrier and four or five destroyers or destroyer escorts, and all they did was hunt submarines. And I had to chuckle. They did a documentary on the capture of U-505, and the radio officer on board the Guadalcanal, they interviewed him, and he had a high, squeaky voice, and he said, "Imagine that in this whole huge ocean, we just happened to run onto this German submarine." No, you dummy. They were sent there because we had cracked the code. Of course, they didn't know that at the time, and Captain Gallery, he became Rear Admiral later, he damn near got court-martialed over it because two things. First off, he wasn't supposed to capture any submarine. He was supposed to sink it. And they captured the boat 2 days before D-Day, and they were just scared to death that the Germans would find out they captured the boat and had the codes, which would have caused them to change their codes for the whole D-Day invasion. We'd have been coming in blind, but we had their codes. That's how they knew to send the Guadalcanal Task Force there. And the second reason, the commander of a ship is not supposed to leave his ship. The commander of a task group is not supposed to leave his flagship. He went aboard 505 after they captured it. He wanted to see his new toy. He got out of that by saying he was demolition trained, and he wanted to disarm the so-called scuttling charges.
Mm-hmm.
There were no scuttling charges on submarines. Who would go to war in a ship of any kind knowing that there was charges on board that, you know, when the enemy got you cornered, you just push this button and blow yourself out of the water? It don't work that way. There were no scuttling charges, but he ducked a court-martial that way. And that's the submarine that wound up in Chicago.
And still there today.
Oh, yeah. I've got more hours on board that submarine than some of the crew, because I was born and raised in Chicago. I watched that thing get pulled up on the shore of Lake Michigan.
No kidding. Still with its markings on it?
No, they had repainted, and it said U-505 on the side. Prior to that, it had the Shell Oil emblem on the side, and that's a long story. But, you know, that was my 15th birthday, Labor Day weekend of 1954. And we were going down Lakeshore Drive to go around the bottom of Lake Michigan to Granddad's farm to spend the long weekend, and I thought to myself, who the hell would want this thing? Well, now I know.
Do they want to keep it in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. They've just gone through a huge renovation. They moved it. It had been set next to the Museum of Science and Industry. And then they built an addition across the front of it, an addition to the museum. Then they built another one along the starboard side. So suddenly now the submarine was inside of a giant U. So you could hardly see it. So they built a new structure for it, and they moved it, and from what I understand, it's really well preserved. Of course, the guides there don't have a clue. These are a bunch of people who don't know what the hell they're talking about. Some of my people went through it and told me that the guide was saying that when it was captured, some of the crew had American money and U.S. cigarettes on them.
They
said they had been ashore on the east coast of the U.S., and I tried to explain to them that boat was never in American waters, ever. Oh, no, they didn't want they had fact checkers, they said. I told them we'd check anything they needed for them for free so they wouldn't look stupid. Oh, no, they had fact checkers. The guy who used to be the head of the museum there, Jack Kahn, was a super guy. He and I had a great rapport. Anything they needed to know about the submarine, he'd call. We'd go there. Everything was fine. Then he retired, and they got a guy who had been in charge of the buses in Chicago. and he's on some kind of ivory tower. You can't even talk to him. I used to be able to just pick up the phone and call Jack Kahn. You can't even talk to this guy. He's got stooges and underlings. I guess, you know, he's from the same place Barack Obama is, so I guess he's the emperor of the museum.
All right.
But we'll let that one pass.
Yeah, we will for the moment. Lots to talk about. Here's the music. That means we pause for our last break. We'll come back and take a look at two, three more
sharkhunters.
covers.
Sharkhunters.com.
And indeed, sharkhunters.com. What a website. All right. Be
Thank
right
you.
Back. Okay, and we're back. All right, we're talking with David Dees, the artist of the books in question right now. We're looking at those. You can just click under Harry Cooper's name on books, and you'll see them. We're looking at Volume 4, which is really another masterpiece. This is a night scene. Just amazing. Why were these boats on the surface running all lit up like Disneyland at night? You'd think that they'd go dark.
Well, the neutral ships, I mean, ships from neutral countries, were required to be well lit.
Uh-huh.
And that way, they had their national flag painted on the side of the ship. So, you know, if it was Portuguese or various other, neutral countries, they wouldn't get shot. So they'd be all lit up at night. And a lot of times the submarines would spend hours chasing down a ship, getting into a proper firing position and only to find out it was a neutral ship. Okay, fine. We wasted a lot of time. Let's go find somebody else. Give me a couple of seconds. I want to tell you a couple of funny stories about the guys on these covers, if I may.
Sure.
On Volume 2, that's Eric Topp, the third most successful submarine commander of the war. I've been in his home many times over there, and he came over in the year 2000 for a big convention we had. There were several U-boaters, several Soviet skippers, etc. And so we got him a nice room in the hotel, and I was talking to him on the phone, and he said he was a widower by then. He says, Harry, I have a nurse who travels with me. I said, okay, we'll get her to the room next to yours with a door between. No, she must be in my room to take care of me. I said, okay, fine, Eric. You don't argue with these old guys. So I went to pick him up at the airport. Okay, we got him the penthouse suite for him and his nurse. He was 82, and here he comes with his nurse. He's a gorgeous 22-year-old. So I told my wife about it, and I said, when I get to be 82, I want a nurse like that. My wife says, you talk like that, you ain't going to make it to 82. Then if you look at the cover of U-Boat 5, the upper left-hand corner, that's Reinhard Hardagen. I've been to his home in Germany, I don't know how many times. He's been here twice to visit. He turned 101 last March. He's closing in on 102 this current March.
Wow.
And I got an email from his oldest son, and he said the three kids, two sons and a daughter, they're panic-stricken because their father, at 101 years old, is still driving his Mercedes. I told him that he should move to Florida. That's the norm down here. And then, sadly, the lower left picture on U-Boat 5, that was my best friend in Germany, Hess. He was the youngest combat commander who saw heavy combat. There were a couple of guys younger than him, but he saw heavy combat. I was over to visit him some years ago. He was 82 years old. He was in great shape. A couple months later, the main TV station over there and one of their researchers came out with a horribly defamatory so-called special about the nasty guys in the Wehrmacht. And my friend Hess was a doctor of law. He filed a pretty massive lawsuit against this researcher and the studio, and would you believe, within a week, he had a heart attack and died. Damn coincidence.
Oh, really? One of those coincidences.
Yeah.
Never quit.
Hey, let me throw out a special offer to your listeners. I've never done this before. If any of your listeners order any of our books, they can call us, the phone number is on the website, sharkhunters.com, and say that they heard us on the Rents radio program. We'll give them a 6-month membership for free where they get the magazine.
Oh, What a deal. What a deal. The magazine is magnificent. It's, I don't know how you do it.
It comes electronically. You get it. You know what it's like.
Yeah.
So for 6 months, they'll get the magazine. They'll get all the benefits of membership. The magazine comes electronically as you get it. If they mention they saw or heard us on the Rents Radio program tonight and order any of these books, they get a free six-month membership.
Well, again, they're history, living history, told by the people who lived it. And there's nothing like that, nothing. Just extraordinary. The last cover we have on the page is David's most recent non-U-boat or Eagles cover. It's the Hitler and the Secret Alliance, which I again, think is a marvelous cover.
Especially, oh, that's probably one of the best he's done. That's beautiful.
Well, the bottom, the bottom of it, showing the swastika floating in the, on the gorgeous lake. Just amazing. I don't
There's
know
a whole lot more story behind that than what even David knows. What is more than you know, and one of these days I'll tell you. But there's a, it just by sheer coincidence, that's what he did. But there's a hell of a story behind that image.
Wow. Which lake is that?
Yep. That's a lake down there.
That, which lake is that?
I don't know which lake, David. What lake did you pick?
That would be the lake. Let's see. It's the town was Bariloche.
At Bariloche.
Yeah.
So that's the big lake.
Yeah, that's Lake Nahuelwapi.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, that on that. That's the lake. That's the lake. Up one finger of which had the residence built by the Mercedes family that Hitler and Eva lived in for 10 years.
That's right. Incidentally, we have a brand new website, so if they go to sharkhunters.com, you know, they've got all sorts of options. We have a shopping cart on there, too. But unless they call us and tell us that they heard us on Rents Radio, we won't know to give them the free six-month membership. So our phone number is on there. They can get anything they like. Our fine art prints that are hand-signed by these great veterans, Americans, some Americans, mostly Germans.
Uh-huh.
Our DVDs, our CDs, also our books. They've got a shopping cart, and with PayPal, they can use any old form of payment, including wampum beads, I guess. But if they call us and order the books from us over the phone and say they heard us on Rents Radio tonight, they get a six-month free membership, and they'll get the magazine electronically.
Very good. All right. David, anything you want to add in summation here? We got about three minutes left.
I'd like everybody to go buy these books. I think if you collected all of them, you would have a piece of history that very few people would ever be able to own. You could make a great library out of them.
Well, you can educate yourself literally about an epoch in our relatively current history that few understand, except for the propaganda crap that is forced down our throats from the time we begin government schools.
Triumph over evil, right? Yeah, that's what's on one of the TV channels now.
Is that it? Triumph over evil.
Yeah. Incidentally, there's another, I think you know, Jeff, the Hitler in Argentina book, we are offering that in hard copy, but it's not for sale. We'll give it to anybody free if they make a donation of $150 or more to our nonprofit corporation, Shark Hunters Institute. And that's funding my next expedition down there, as you know, to Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and Paraguay. And, anybody who donates $150 or more gets a hard copy. There's only 200 made, period. They're numbered. They ain't going to be more than 200. They also get a copy of that DVD, 90-minute long DVD that
which I have not seen yet, and in fact, I haven't gotten mine yet. Hopefully, you can find one. Tell Santa.
Hell, I'll send you one. I thought we had sent you a DVD already.
And the book, I'd love to get a copy of the book, too.
Okay, and then
my illustrated book, remember that?
David, his own book, we want to mention. David Dees has his first edition out of covers that he's done for Rents.com. Splash art covers.
Wow.
and you can get them. Tell them where to go, David, to get it.
The web, it's my website. It's spelled DDEES.com. That's DDEES.com.
That book go there is, go ahead.
And it's, there's a button you can click. It says the book, and it's 114, full color, pages, and it's
stunning
awesome.
Covers. There, David's splash art, is again, without any equal on the planet. I've seen a few people try and copy him, but no one can do it. There's some inspiration
really
there that comes from somewhere that is just, in a whole nother level. And it's always a thrill to see these things materialize and get worked out and to be able to post them. So go to ddees.com, DDEES.com, and get a copy of that book, another fabulous Christmas gift. That book you hand to anyone, and they open it up at any page, and it immediately provokes thought. It, you cannot look at it or any of those images and not start thinking about important issues. It's an incredible medium that he has pioneered and brought forward. It's just remarkable. So do that, hopefully. Thank you, David, for being here.
Thank you, and good night, Harry.
Good night, David.
Okay.
Later.
All right, Mr. Cooper, I'm going to say good night to you. There's a story I ran today, last night late, about one of Hitler's watercolors going up for auction. They're expecting around $50,000, $60,000 for it. It's a very handsome painting done in 1915, and I wish I was in a position to bid on it. I'm still.
yeah, you and me both.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to visit a friend over there, Manfred Roeder, who was the most radical right winger according to the government there, and the room I had an original Hitler painting hanging in it.
Yeah, well,
guy was a pretty fair artist.
You know, he's a very good artist. You know my story about six I had and the small ones. And so anyway, look around the military show there. See what you see.
If I see your pictures, I'll holler.
Or if you see one for sale, buy it for me and I'll pay you back. All right.
Yeah. I got about $40 in my pocket right now.
All right. Have fun, Harry. Thanks. Been great.
All right. Sharkhunters.com. Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Of
Good
course.
Talking to you always.
Thank you. Get well. All righty.
All righty.
Okay. Harry Cooper. And that's hour number two. We'll be right back with hour three in just a few minutes.